Hello, and welcome to In the Same Vein, our podcast about how medicine, the humanities, and ethics are all intertwined. I'm Dr. Christy Slobogan, and I'm an assistant professor of health humanities and bioethics at the University of Rochester Medical Center.
And I'm Maya Daniello. I'm a junior undergraduate student at the University of Rochester, interested in doing an MD-PhD. Today, we're talking to Dr. Jonathan Harrington, an assistant professor in the Department of Health Humanities and Bioethics with joint appointment in the philosophy department here at the University of Rochester. His research focuses on the political philosophy of science, health, and technology, specifically using the tools of political philosophy to interrogate the governance of health technologies, dual-use research, fairness in machine learning algorithms, resource allocation during health emergencies, and secondary research ethics.
So today, we're mostly talking to Dr. Harrington about resource allocation during health emergencies. We read one of his recent articles done with a whole team, mostly here from the University of Rochester, published in September of 2024, and it's titled Investigating Ethical Trade-offs in Crisis Standards of Care Through Simulation of Ventilator Allocation Protocols. So we have a really interesting conversation about this article and its implications. We talk a lot, of course, about ventilator allocation. We talk about the COVID pandemic. We talk about the benefits and potential risks of using data to answer ethical questions as related to healthcare. We talk about racial disparities. We talk about the difference between saving lives and saving life years. And then we also talk about why these questions around bioethics and resource allocation are so important for philosophers, for medical students, for future medical professionals, for current medical professionals to really engage with. We end with that major question of this podcast of why these questions, these humanities and bioethics informed questions need to be part of the medical conversation. So then Maya, could you tell us a little bit about why this interests you and why you wanted to talk to Dr. Harrington today for this episode?
Yeah. I will say that up until we read this article for this podcast, I hadn't really given a lot of thought specifically to ventilator allocation, but I do think that these larger problems of resource allocation and deciding who gets treatment when is really important in the medical field as a whole. I also am particularly partial to bioethics as I study bioethics here at the University of Rochester, and I have worked with Dr. Harrington on bioethical translational research before. And I just think that these are very important for understanding as future doctors, future medical professionals.
Yeah, so we hope that you all enjoy our episode, and thank you so much for listening.
Hello, and welcome to our podcast. I'm so happy that we could talk to you today, Dr. Harrington, and we're just going to jump into our first question. So to prepare for this podcast episode, we read your article, Investigating Ethical Trade-offs in Crisis, Standards of Care Through Simulation of Ventilator Allocation Protocols. Could you just give us a summary of that article for our listeners so that we're all on the same page?
Thanks, Maya, for having me. I want everyone to kind of think back to the early part of the pandemic, right? And I know that's a kind of a struggle for a lot of us. It was not a happy time. But during the early part of the pandemic, you know, we were really worried about potential shortages of ventilators. Now, luckily, that never happened in most places. We got a little close in New York City for a short period of time. And that experience early on in the pandemic created a lot of anxiety about the number of patients potentially exceeding the number of critical care beds that hospitals had available. And so across the United States, different states adopted very different criteria for how to fairly allocate ventilators in the event of a shortage. And those criteria are called crisis standards of care protocols. So it's a crisis and there's a change in the standards of care that we use. So different states had different approaches to these criteria. So for instance, in New York, the goal was to prioritize people who are most likely to survive their hospital stay. And the way that they did that in New York was to use a measure of how acutely ill someone was, how many of their major organs were failing. And that's a measure called the Sequential Organ Failure Assessment Score, which is a bit of a mouthful. It has this sort of cute acronym SOFA. And that score was used to decide who was going to receive the ventilator in New York. On the other hand, in Colorado, they used a very different sort of metric. They used SOFA, but they were also interested in prioritizing people who are likely to survive for a number of years beyond their hospital stay, right? So they weren't just interested in who was going to leave the hospital. They wanted to ensure that they gave the ventilators to people who were going to live for a significant number of years beyond their hospital stay. And so what they did was that they used SOFA, but they added other stuff to it. They looked at the presence of serious comorbidities like uncontrolled diabetes, liver disease, end-stage renal disease, metastatic cancer. And they also placed priority on giving ventilators to younger people, right? So you had these states with very different approaches to allocating ventilators. And a lot of people claimed there were going to be big differences, big trade-offs between these different state plans, that some state plans would really save more lives to discharge, right? Would get more people out of the hospital. Others would save more years of life, which is just the idea that you would save sort of younger people or people who are going to live for longer after they were discharged. And others would said that some of these protocols would really create huge racial disparities, right? And luckily, we didn't have to actually use these plans. So one of the things that was sort of interesting about this is we didn't have any really hard data about whether or not these trade-offs existed because we were lucky enough that we didn't have to use the plans. And so our team got interested in gathering that hard data. We wanted to know what would have happened if you'd implemented these protocols. We decided to do that by using computer simulations to explore what would have happened if you'd used different protocols to allocate ventilators in an actual patient population. And the details of that are slightly complex. They're complex even to me who did the work. But the basic idea is that we recorded data on everyone who received ventilator support at the University of Rochester for an entire year. So we collected this big patient database of actual patients who received ventilator support during the pandemic, between about April 2020 and March 2021. That turned out to be about 3,700 people, right, over that period. And then we took that database and we used a computer simulation method called a Monte Carlo simulation to randomly select patients and apply each protocol to that pair of patients to decide who would get the ventilator. And then in every single simulation run, we would make decisions about all 3,700 people in our data set and then record the average number of lives saved or the estimated number of life years saved in that simulation. And then we did that 1,000 times for every protocol. This is the benefit of using computers. You can do things a lot. You can repeat things a lot. So that's how we did the simulation. The results revealed sort of three big things. First, the protocols that included age as a criteria consistently outperformed all the other protocols, both in terms of the number of life years they saved, but also in terms of the number of lives they saved to discharge. So age was a really strong predictor of who was going to leave the hospital, independent of sort of how acutely ill someone was. The second big thing that we learned was that there wasn't really a trade-off between saving lives to discharge, getting people out of the hospital, and saving life years, saving people who are likely to live for a significant number of years beyond their hospital stay. And that's kind of interesting because that's not what the ethical literature assumed, right? It assumed there was this big trade-off between the number of lives saved and the number of life years that you'd save. The third big thing that we found was that there's a trade-off between equalizing the survival rates across racial groups and maximizing the number of lives saved overall. So, for instance, the protocol that was adopted in New York, while it would have equalized the survival rate across racial groups, resulted in fewer lives saved overall. And that particularly, it resulted in fewer lives saved for Black and Hispanic populations.
So you already alluded to this a bit in the beginning of your answer. You know, when you talked about at the beginning of COVID, there was all of this anxiety about who is going to get ventilators and when are we going to run out of them and what's going to happen. But I was wondering if you wanted to speak a little bit more about what sparked this investigation for you and your team. Was it something particular to the University of Rochester or Rochester as a city? Or was it something more general, more national that kind of sparked wanting to do this work?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think it was sort of sparked by two different things. The first was the experience of helping to create the ventilator allocation protocol that we were prepared to use at the University of Rochester, but didn't end up having to use. So in 2015, New York State had gone through this long, very comprehensive process to create guidelines for rationing ventilators in the event of a flu pandemic. They had worried about a flu pandemic occurring, and they were very interested in creating guidelines to ensure that, you know, doctors weren't forced to make decisions at the bedside. And it was very comprehensive. It included input from lots of religious groups, disability rights groups, ethicists, clinicians, lawyers. And that was the basis for our protocol that we developed here at the University of Rochester. But it had to be altered for the particular clinical presentation of COVID. And during the pandemic, I watched the clinicians and the ethicists that we worked with really struggle to select the precise metrics, the precise criteria that we should use, the cutoffs in terms of how sick someone needed to be before they were going to be deprioritized. And people working to try and meet this overall goal that we had, which was to save the most number of lives to discharge, right? But implementing that in concrete criteria felt very difficult. There was not a lot of hard data. We had to make guesses and assumptions about how the pandemic would unfold. On top of that, we were quite worried about things like racial disparities in who was going to survive experience in the ICU. And we wanted to ensure that we weren't allocating ventilators unfairly, right, in ways that were kind of would deepen racial disparities that we were seeing in who got COVID and who was dying of COVID. And so partially this work was prompted by that experience of people struggling through the data and not having access to good sort of fine-tuned criteria about how to allocate ventilators. And the idea was doing a data-driven study could help solve that problem. The other thing that kind of motivated the study was I got really frustrated by some of the bioethical literature. There was a lot of sort of discussion in the bioethical literature about the appropriate principles to ration ventilators. And it was very abstract, relying on kind of hypothetical choices between two individuals, right? So people would say, imagine a decision between a very sick 30-year-old and a slightly sick 80-year-old and trying to make a philosophical case for making judgments between those two people, and then using those judgments to help inform criteria that they were going to apply to a whole population. And I found that kind of way of thinking through the ethical quandary really unsatisfying because it wasn't informed by data about how these criteria would play out at a population level. It was sort of working in the way that bioethicists are used to working, which is dealing with these hypotheticals, dealing with highly abstract principles, like whether we should prioritize the number of lives saved or whether we should prioritize the number of life years we save, but just sort of assumed that there were value trade-offs in practice, right? And didn't ask whether those trade-offs were real, given the protocols being proposed by states, or just sort of theoretically possible. I felt, again, like a data-driven study could help solve that problem.
I really liked your answer to that question. I think it also, as you were speaking, made me think of the topical issue of abortion bans and when to decide when someone is sick enough to need treatment, and the similar trade-off of when do you decide if somebody is deserving of treatment. And a lot of what you're talking about particularly are some of the benefits of using data in this way to try to answer ethical questions. And I'm wondering about some of the potential risks of using data.
I really like this question because I think I've been doing this sort of work for a couple of years now, and I'm naturally sort of predisposed to thinking that data is good, that that being able to quantify things can be really helpful. It helps you be more precise. It helps you like see the impact of policies and at a population level. But, you know, this question is really helpful because there are real risks to trying to capture ethical problems with numbers, right? And I think one of the biggest risks is that it's really hard to capture the why of decisions, right? Why did that person need care? Why did that person, need an abortion, for instance, right? Why did that person need ventilator support? That stuff's really hard to capture in a medical database. Sometimes you can capture that kind of stuff in free text notes, but those kind of explanatory notes that clinicians write are really hard to then try and extract and put into some kind of computer simulation or turn into a set of structured variables or features that you can apply across many thousands of people. And I'll give you an example from the study that we're talking about. So some patients, when they receive ventilator support, die because they or their loved ones chose to stop receiving ventilator treatment. So they have a trial of ventilator support, and either that trial feels too burdensome for the patient given their circumstances, or they don't improve in the way that their family members hoped that they would. And at that point, sometimes patients themselves, if they're, if they're awake and competent, make these kinds of decisions, but often family members make decisions to withdraw ventilator support. And that decision is actually not easily captured in most data sets. It's often recorded in a note, right? It's called compassionate extubation, which basically means that there was a compassionate withdrawal of ventilator support. And it's quite hard to gather that data. And in fact, in our study, we didn't gather that data, right? We couldn't extract that data from the University of Rochester's medical database. And so that might skew the results in our study in unknown ways. It's hard to know who died because they, in some sense, chose to die or chose to have the ventilator withdrawn, and who died because we did everything we could for them, but they were too sick to leave the hospital.
That is a really good answer. And that example is really helpful for understanding kind of the limits of data in this kind of study. These are also really, really tough questions to be thinking about and trying to, run the study on. And we were just saying, we've had conversations with family members about okay, if I'm on a ventilator or if I'm on life support, what do you do? What would I want you to do? And those are tough things to think about. And obviously we all lived through COVID. And so we know how much of an emotional burden just thinking about COVID all the time is. And so we wanted to ask perhaps more personal question of what did it feel like to do this research? And how do you think that it related to your own experiences during the COVID pandemic?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I absolutely feel that tension, right? Like doing this work, like I'm looking at a spreadsheet, right? Or a big data set where, you know, whether or not someone left the hospital is coded as either a zero or a one, right? Literally binary numbers capturing the end of someone's life. And, you know, there is something a little bit perverse about doing that, right? About doing that work. But, you know, I also felt like these questions are so important at the population level, and these policies can have such a big impact on people's lives and the fairness of the decisions that we make in these kinds of crises, that I really found it kind of cathartic to work through this data, to work on a sort of very concrete problem that I thought could really help us deal with the next pandemic and make it more equitable, more just, and improve the outcomes for as many people as possible, right? The other thing that I should say is that it wasn't just me doing this work, right? So, like, one of the things that I learned during the process of helping to create the ventilator protocol and then extracting the data and then doing the simulations was that it really requires an enormous team of people to do this work. So at the University of Rochester, our response to the pandemic, trying to change the protocol that we had been given by New York so that it fit the particular circumstances of COVID, our response at the University of Rochester was led by our director of the Clinical Ethics Service, Dr. Margie Shaw, and a really big team of clinical ethicists, critical care physicians, theologians, lawyers, right, to try and really think through the guidelines that we were given and change them into something that was workable for COVID. And then even though we didn't implement that protocol and didn't have to start rationing, our bioinformatics team did an enormous amount of work, particularly at the Clinical and Translational Science Institute, to produce an automated scorecard for our protocol so that we wouldn't have to be hand tallying the SOFA scores, the organ dysfunction scores. And so we could sort of allocate ventilators as quickly as possible and also without human biases sort of entering into the calculation process. And I had a relatively small part at that stage. Like, I was not yet a faculty member within the bioethics unit. And so I volunteered as a triage officer whose basic role was to take the database's judgments and translate the automated scoring into actual decisions for individual patients. And that whole process sort of really emphasized to me how difficult the value judgments were when you're trying to develop these protocols in a crisis situation, and then also how many people are required to help set up a system that is fair, equitable, transparent, and ultimately efficient at allocating these really scarce resources.
Awesome. That was really, really interesting. So in your answer, this is the second time that you've mentioned either religious groups or leaders and theologians. And we were just really curious, like, what role do they play in this decision and why is it important to involve them?
Yeah, so I think that's a really good question, because I think often when we think about these kinds of public policy decisions, we say to ourselves, well, we don't want policy decisions being influenced by the private religious commitments of particular communities. But I think what's really important to recognize is that those communities are part of the population that we serve, right? And those the commitments that people have, their religious commitments in particular, are really often intrinsically linked with their views about how the end of their life should happen, right? And what kinds of values they think are important in terms of what kinds of lives are worth living and how they want people who are helping them through the end of their life, or people who are hopefully helping them extend their life, how those people who are caring for them treat them as they are making decisions about, particularly difficult decisions about who gets resources allocated when there's scarcity. And so, you know, I mentioned the New York State guidelines in 2015 were developed in concert with people, theologians who came from different faith traditions, right? But also from different stakeholders who represented people who had a big interest in figuring out a fair and equitable way of distributing these scarce resources. So disability rights groups were a big part of the New York State ventilator allocation guidelines process. And I think, you know, one of the things we have to sort of work through as a community and as a society is figuring out how to navigate deep disagreement with one another about the values that we have, right? And about how we ought to allocate the scarce resources that we have in a way that's fair and equitable and just. And I think what that means is we need to talk to one another, even if we fundamentally disagree about what the foundational truths are and what the foundational meaning is in our life.
Thank you so much for that answer. That's really beautiful. And I agree, very important, especially now. So moving on to our next question, I feel like we have a really good understanding of the paper overall and the decisions that you made and your reasons for conducting these simulations. But we are curious about the details of a Monte Carlo simulation and why they're useful for this problem, and also what other kinds of questions, ethical or otherwise, that this type of simulation can help us to answer.
Awesome. So let me put my nerd hat on for a second. So I hope you'll join me on this journey as we nerd out a little bit.
Your nerd hat has been on the whole time, and both of our nerd hats have been on this whole time too. It's just a slightly different nerd hat, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's good. Let's be in community together. That's what we're here to do. So a Monte Carlo simulation, it's basically just a statistical method for dealing with uncertainty in computer simulations. So basically the results of any computer simulation are just very sensitive to the assumptions that you make in that simulation. The results can really change if you make certain assumptions. And often those assumptions are things that we just can't really know ahead of time, right? So the simulation is sensitive to stuff that we shouldn't really assume to be one way or the other. So, you know, here's a few examples, right? What's the order in which the patients come to the hospital? How sick are each of those patients? What's their race or their age or their comorbidities? All of those things, the simulation is sensitive to all of those things. And that means that we need to try and incorporate our uncertainty about those things into the simulation in order to get a more accurate result. And so a Monte Carlo method basically works like this. It creates all the possible ways in which those factors might be mixed, and then randomly draws out pairs of patients to make decisions between those patients. And the idea is, by randomly drawing out pairs of patients, you're sort of dealing with the uncertainty by allowing it to sort of randomly occur, right? Instead of assuming that patients come in a particular order, you just sort of have a random distribution of those patients. And so what you do is that you, in a single simulation run, you get a particular ordering of patients who are paired in a particular set of ways. And so when you do a single simulation, you get one possible way in which all those things could be structured together. And so a Monte Carlo method says, you should do those things lots of times in order to figure out what the average result is going to be across the many different ways in which the patients could be ordered, right? So in our protocol, in our simulation, for each protocol, we did that 1,000 times. And so what you end up with is an average number of lives saved or estimated number of lives saved across 3.7 million patients that are drawn from our data set of 3,700.
One of the things that's most interesting to us perhaps is the distinction between most lives saved and most life years saved. And you've already touched on this a fair amount, but I'm wondering if you could just elaborate upon that distinction and why it matters.
Sure. So saving the most lives, right, is a shorthand for talking about maximizing the total number of individuals who survive the immediate crisis, who survive their hospital stay. So that sort of is grounded in this ethical principle, which is that each individual life has equal weight, regardless of the person's remaining lifespan, right? So for instance, two individuals, one in their 20s and another in their 80s, would be considered equally worthy of receiving the life-saving resource, the ventilator. Or alternatively, if you are part of the disability rights community, this might be pretty important to you, because imagine two individuals, one who is in their 20s and has a kind of normal lifespan or doesn't have a life-limiting disability or a severe chronic disability, and another who does have a life-limiting disability, perhaps they have cystic fibrosis, right? The idea is that both those people's lives would be given equal weight in a scenario where we are solely concerned about the number of lives we save to discharge. The alternative sort of principle that people sometimes appeal to is to say, well, actually what we should care about is saving the most life years. And basically what that means is we want to maximize the aggregate number of remaining years of life that are saved across the whole population, right? So, you know, I'm a male who's, approaching his 40s, right? So I plausibly have about 40 years of life left, right? Whereas, you know, a woman in her 70s plausibly has 15 years of life left. Were we to make a decision, if we were equally sick or equally likely to be discharged, the idea is that the saving the most life years principle would prefer to save me rather than the older woman, because what we care about is maximizing the number of life years that we save across the whole population. Why this kind of matters, right, is that traditionally there's been this assumption that these goals are in tension, requiring a really difficult ethical choice between them, between sort of maximizing the number of productive life years that we save and ensuring that we treat people equitably regardless of their age and their comorbidity or their disability status. And there's been this assumption that these two goals are in tension, but our simulation results sort of challenge that assumption. They say the protocols that saved more lives also tended to save more life years. In particular, what was really surprising about the simulation results is that ones that were sensitive to people's age emerged as the most effective in both saving lives to discharge and life years. And this stems from a really kind of strong connection between age and surviving hospital discharge.
What I keep thinking about is, yes, you can estimate life years left, but you never truly know how many life years left a person has. Like a 25-year-old could die when they're 26, and a 70-year-old could live until they're 102. So I find that really fascinating. Again, it's like where the individual narratives or individual stories get kind of lost in data. I find that so fascinating.
Yeah, I find it fascinating too, because there is a lot of uncertainty for each individual about what their prognosis is going to be. And we don't have good methods of estimating for an individual how long that individual's life is going to be. And so, you know, I think this is another one of those uncapturable things, right? It's another one of those ways in which treating these questions as a question of data really is only appropriate at the population level, and because it really obliterates the sort of individual narrative structure of people's lives and sort of ignores or hides the sort of ineliminable uncertainty that we have about our own life course.
Thank you so much for that answer. We have a bit of a multi-part question for you next, so I'm just going to read it all and then you can give your response. So why do state protocols for ventilator allocation vary so greatly in the first place? And why are there so many different approaches to this problem? Because as we've been discussing, this is a really important issue and has a lot of implications. And given that, like, why aren't we standardizing these procedures across the board? And are you hoping that maybe this research helps to have that happen?
Yeah, this is a really difficult question to answer. I mean, let's start by thinking about why the different states have different protocols and why there are so many different approaches to the problem. And I think, you know, the first thing to remind ourselves of is that there is just genuine disagreement over what values we should prioritize. You know, so in New York, the commission that created the 2015 protocol, they were very clearly concerned about discrimination against the elderly or people with disabilities. They worked really hard to try and pick a set of clinical criteria that didn't include people's comorbidities, so their sort of chronic conditions, and didn't include age as a criteria. They excluded those because they were just really concerned about equal treatment. In Colorado and Maryland as well, which also had quite comprehensive processes. They were very thoughtful. They included community consultation in both processes. The potential for unequal treatment or discrimination, potential discrimination by age or potential discrimination based on people's chronic conditions, was thought to be outweighed by the additional predictive power those features have when trying to figure out who's going to survive a hospital stay. You know, one thing to always keep in mind is all societies, but maybe in particular the United States, we are not a monolith, right? We are a big, diverse country with a big range of views about how we ought to live our lives, what lives are worth living, how we ought to allocate the resources that we produce collectively. And so what you end up with is a set of different approaches that emerge in different states. And also, in fact, in some states, there was no state level plan. And so you ended up with different approaches at the hospital system level. So you ended up with very granular sort of approaches. And so some people, I think, feel that that's a mistake, right? Where you end up receiving care or which state you happen to live in shouldn't determine what kinds of treatment you get or what kinds of healthcare resources are available to you. And I think that's a principle that a lot of us share. In the context of crisis standards of care protocols, there are groups working on trying to standardize them to improve them. And, you know, the work that we did here is in part pushing towards that. It's trying to get people to think a little bit about the population level effects of the protocols that were proposed and to see, you know, what are the actual ethical trade-offs that there are, not just what are the trade-offs we presume or assume there to be. But I think it's going to be tricky to standardize. I think in part because of that value disagreement that's sort of difficult to navigate. And then also because different hospitals have very different access to data. You know, some big academic medicine hospitals, places like the University of Rochester, have a lot of resources and have really, you know, reasonably well-structured electronic health records and medical databases. For other smaller hospital systems, right, they can't get that data as easily or as quickly. And so having a fancy sort of standardized algorithm for allocating these scarce resources, you know, that's maybe not that useful for those folks. I mean, you know, we're still using fax machines in some parts of healthcare, right? And so the idea that we can start allocating critical care resources using a fancy standardized algorithm, I think, requires us to really improve upon the infrastructure first.
That's really wild. I've actually never even seen a fax machine before, so.
Be lucky. You're lucky that you've never seen a fax machine.
It's come up quite a bit so far in our conversation, and one of the focuses of this article and the study is race and racial disparities. And obviously, this is a hugely important issue when you're talking about crisis and response and resource allocation. So could you speak more to the role of race and racial disparities in this research and then broaden it out to the importance of taking this into account in bioethics research in general?
Yeah. I mean, I think in the work we're talking about here, the interest in race is primarily motivated by big disparities that we saw in mortality between racial subpopulations during the pandemic. So in general, the proportion of people who died of COVID differed quite a bit between racial and ethnic subgroups. So some people suggested that because of those disparities in COVID mortality, we should strive to ensure that ventilator allocation resulted in equal rates of survival across racial subgroups in order to ensure that any allocation protocol that we were creating wasn't compounding racial inequities in COVID-related mortality. In our study, surprisingly, we found that all protocols except a pure lottery, a kind of random assignment, or the New York State protocol actually, resulted in lower allocation rates and lives saved and life years saved for white patients compared to black and Hispanic patients. And that's surprising because it's the reverse of what we expected given national trends. And, you know, there's a long sort of complicated discussion to have about why we saw that in our particular data set. It's probably related to some specifics about the patient population at the University of Rochester. But while the New York protocol resulted in equal allocation rates and more equal survival rates between different racial subgroups, it also reduced the number of lives saved overall and the number of lives saved for Black and Hispanic populations without really increasing survival amongst white patients at all. So if you had selected the New York State protocol as the way of allocating ventilators, you would have ended up with equal rates of survival across the different racial subgroups. But if you'd selected the other protocols, the Colorado protocol or a pure age-based protocol or the Maryland protocol, you would have had unequal rates of survival. But what those unequal rates of survival would have involved is higher rates of survival for Black and Hispanic populations without lower rates of survival for white populations. And what that sort of complex result suggests is that conversations about racial equity need to be carefully considered. So insisting on equal rates of survival across racial groups might simply reduce the overall number of lives saved with little benefit for the populations who are worst off overall. And you might be better served by thinking about which are the protocols that do the best for each racial subpopulation, that save the most lives in each racial subpopulation, because those protocols might be the ones that people would prefer.
Awesome. Thank you. So looking more at the big picture, why do you think that it's helpful or even vital for medical trainees or those hoping to go into medicine to start understanding bioethics as a field with articles and problems such as this?
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes when I talk to medical trainees and people who are interested in going into medicine, bioethical questions sort of seem like they are a separate universe from their medical training, right? Like we have a lecture on, you know, informed consent, and we sit there and we learn the rules, and then we like go back to our like proper medical training. And so I think one of the benefits of doing this sort of data-driven bioethics, or bioethics that's really deeply, deeply embedded in an empirical problem, is that it helps people who are interested in going into medicine understand that bioethics is deeply connected with the work that they do. And it also, frankly, puts the bioethical problems in a language that a lot of medical students are much more comfortable sort of diving into, right? So, you know, the article that we're talking about here is written by a philosopher, but it follows the structure of a traditional medical journal article, right? There's an introduction and then a method section and a results section and a discussion. It has graphs in it, graphs in it. There are tables with numbers, right? And I think sometimes being able to translate our work into a different kind of language structure just really helps broaden the impact of that work and helps introduce people to concepts in ways that they're happier or more comfortable with than traditional bioethical reasoning or traditional kind of philosophical reasoning.
Yeah, that's really awesome. I have to say, I am definitely a bit biased when thinking about like how these issues are so important and how bioethics is just so important to this field. But as a future medical student, it's something that I have always just really found super important to talk about, like how these things to me feel so overlapping, and how in that discussion, you find so many people who think that they are so separate. So being able to open those doors and help people see the connection is really awesome and really important.
On that theme of the overlaps of these fields, you know, this podcast is called In the Same Vein. You know, we're thinking about how these things, how these disciplines, medicine, bioethics, humanities, philosophy, all kind of run together. You know, so this is a podcast fully about interdisciplinarity and the overlaps of science and the humanities. And that's very obvious in this work and in the discussion that we've been having. But I wanted to ask a little bit more about you being a philosopher by training. You know, we've talked about the use of data for ethical questions quite a lot in this episode. But I wanted to ask more specifically about how these data-driven questions and answers either grow out of or contradict your training as a philosopher.
Yeah. So a little secret about this project is that it took a long time because, you know, I'm trained as a philosopher. You know, my stock in trade is words, right? It is not computer code. And so during this project, I had to learn how to code the computer simulation. And there was a lot of trial and error, right? I joke about it being baby's first Python project. And, you know, it took a long time for me to figure out how to do this, because I think as philosophers, we just don't have the background or the training in things like computer simulation. On the other hand, right, like, I think philosophers are kind of predisposed to think about these kinds of problems in this particular way, in the very fine-grained, formalized way, right? You know, philosophers love making distinctions. It's our favorite thing to do. We love like carving concepts into, you know, into increasingly small little pieces. And that lends itself to computer programming, right? It lends itself to data-driven research, because we're already comfortable with logical reasoning, theories of causation, probability, etc. Alongside that, you know, philosophers also bring a set of highly sort of formalized theories of fairness and justice that lend themselves to being expressed in mathematical or computational forms. And sometimes, you know, that is just extremely limiting, right? We shouldn't think that all of the dimensions of justice can be expressed in a mathematical formula. But for certain kinds of questions, it does have the virtue of making our assumptions really explicit and making them tractable in a way that lets you tease out the assumptions that you've made in your philosophical reasoning and see whether they really hold in the world that we actually live in. So, you know, on the whole, I think philosophy and sort of data-driven research is pretty consistent. But, you know, I would say that as a analytic philosopher who spends a lot of his time thinking about the ways in which we ought to distribute things and the ways in which we should think about or metricize fairness.
So as we begin to wrap up, and thank you so much for your really insightful answers to all of our very probing questions, we are just really interested in what you are working on next and if you have any big bioethical questions that you would like to use your data and philosophy training in going forward.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I mean, thank you for listening to me rabbit on about my paper today. I think what's next for me is I'm mostly working on questions that arise around the use of artificial intelligence in medicine. You know, as you are probably aware, as our listeners are probably aware, you know, we are rapidly expanding the use of machine learning and artificial intelligence in medicine. It is permeating all sorts of spaces in the way that we deliver care, the way that we distribute resources, the way that we diagnose patients. There is a lot of well-founded concern about bias in these tools. We are sort of worried about the ways in which these tools embed existing disparities in our healthcare system into an automated system that is going to reproduce and deepen some of the inequities that we're familiar with. Fortunately, at the moment, we don't have good metrics of fairness. You know, we talk about bias a lot, but it's hard for us to measure it. And while there's lots of different sort of candidate ways of measuring fairness, they unfortunately seem to conflict with one another. You can't sort of have your cake and eat it too. You can't meet one measure of fairness and also a second measure of fairness at the same time. They're sort of incompatible. And that means that we have to make value judgments. And as I was saying before, community members disagree a lot about what fairness means in the context of healthcare. And so we need to figure out some way of figuring out what people's values are and navigating that disagreement when those values conflict. The next big sort of project that I'm going to be working on over the next few years is to think about how we identify people's preferences for fairness, how we structure the decisions that they get to make about the allocation of resources, and what measures of fairness to use in different contexts so that we can honor the values that our community members have and ensure that the decisions that are made are acceptable to the broadest possible selection of our community.
Thank you so much for that answer. It's going to be really exciting to, you know, see all of the work that you're doing in that space. Thank you again so much for talking to us. Maya and I really appreciated it. And yeah, thank you so much for being on this first season of In the Same Vein.
Yes, this was so awesome. It was really cool and really fun.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was a delight to talk to you both.